Cómo Curar is your natural health show where we translate the science and turn it into useful, practical, and simple education to give you all the tools that you need to say no to any medical sentence. I am Coco March, your host.
Welcome to a new episode of Cómo Curar. Today, I interview the number one hormone expert. She is an endocrine naturopath that will teach us everything that you need to know in order to regulate your hormones. Did you know that menopause can begin as soon as at age 40, even if you still have your period? Sit down, put your seatbelt, and enjoy the interview with my favorite menopause expert, Dr. Jolene Brighton. Hi, Dr. Jolene Brighton. Welcome to Cómo Curar. How are you?
I am fantastic because I'm talking to you today and I get to hang out with your wonderful audience. And I'm so, so excited to be here.
Jolene, I loved your first book, Beyond the Pill, because it was just such a light at the end of the tunnel for so many women, the clear explanations. But then when I thought that was a great book, you came up with a new, even greater book about, is this normal? We deal with the same issues. Sometimes people think, oh, docs don't have issues. We have issues. We have to deal with them. And we know about that things that appear normal are maybe not. Tell me, what are some common issues that are thought like, yeah, they should be normal, but in reality, they are not?
I think one of the most common things that we hear is when we start our period, that it's going to be horrible, that hormones are going to just have you at the mercy of them. You're going to be crying all the time, experiencing PMS, and that those periods will be painful and that you should just accept that. And in reality, hormones are really designed to give you superpowers, to make you feel alive and wonderful in your body. And we received a lot of mismessaging around that.
So you're telling me that painful periods are not normal? Because most women, they have talked to me, I even remember when I was in my 20s, and they think that having to take some anti-inflammatories during your period is expected. So you're saying that's not normal?
Period pain should never be regarded as normal. While it's common, it's not normal to be in so much pain that you can't go to work or school, that you find that you have to take pain meds, so like ibuprofen or NSAIDs all the time, or having that feeling that you can't schedule your life because your period is coming and you just have to be home curled up in a ball, maybe even crying. This shouldn't be regarded as normal. And in fact, the number one cause of painful periods for most women are elevated prostaglandins. These are hormone-like chemicals that cause contractions. So anyone who's ever had a baby is very well acquainted with prostaglandins. They help us usher a human into the world. Wonderful. But having your period every month shouldn't be like having a baby. It should not feel the same. And so if prostaglandins are elevated, we can make simple shifts like including more magnesium in the diet, maybe taking a magnesium supplement, shifting so we have more omega-3 fatty acids opposed to omega-6, which in the United States, the standard American diet is very high in omega-6 fatty acids. And that makes really aggressive prostaglandins that cause those contractions. But outside of that, heavy, painful periods, those can be a sign of something else like endometriosis, adenomyosis, fibroids, and they shouldn't be ignored just because you have a uterus.
Very interesting. And in Beyond the Pill, I recall that you talked specifically about the role that the prostaglandins play in our period to increase our pooping. Like a lot of people, it's like, hey, is it normal that I'm constipated through the whole month and then I get my period and I'm regular? Tell me a little bit about that, because I thought that that was very interesting.
Yeah, well, I love that you remember that from Beyond the Pill, because there's a lot of questions that came from Beyond the Pill that inspired Is This Normal? That I included. So in Beyond the Pill, I said it in passing of like, I asked patients, like, you know, if you have really painful periods, like, do you find that you're pooping a lot? And that points towards prostaglandins. And the number of people who are like, tell me more about period poops. I have had social media pieces like on TikTok blow up with millions of people commenting saying, oh, wait, I'm not the only one who experiences this. So prostaglandins they don't care what they make contract. They cause contractions. And so they can stimulate the uterus and stimulate the bowels. Now, before your period, in that premenstrual phase, elevations in progesterone can slow your bowels. So now maybe you miss a day going to the bathroom, or maybe you just find it's more difficult to go to the bathroom. Then when your period comes and the prostaglandins go up, now you're evacuating your bowels quite aggressively sometimes if those prostaglandins are really elevated. And so it's important to understand that, you know, if you are like, I poop a little bit more on my period, that's normal. If you are having really loose stools, you have to stay near the bathroom, you have diarrhea, that shouldn't be regarded as normal. And if you are that person, I mentioned magnesium. You want magnesium glycinate, not magnesium citrate, because citrate can just increase the frequency in which you're going to the bathroom.
Right. Because it absorbs water in the colon and it just, it's really good. But if you have problems with your prostaglandins, then you want something that is not, it's going to move it, but not wet it. So that's very interesting. But this brings me to the next question, because a lot of women, they think, okay, so I know I have hormones. I feel hormonal per se. How do I know that my hormones are not normal?
Yes. So this is why I put a giant quiz in the book. So there are multiple pages for you to evaluate your hormones. And I think if you're living in your body, you have a sense of what's normal and what's not for you. The trouble is that you know how it is. You go to the doctor and they say to you like, well, I see this all the time, therefore it's normal. Well, it's common, especially who goes to the doctor, but people who don't feel well. So if you are experiencing things like having anxiety, having trouble sleeping at night, you find that your periods are irregular or they're coming more frequently. We could have progesterone issues going on. If you find that, you know, you're gaining weight in your hips, butt, and thighs, your periods are very heavy, you feel irritable before your period, that could be pointing towards estrogen. And then we have other hormones like thyroid hormone, where if our thyroid hormone's too low, we will see that our skin gets dry, we lose hair on our head. We may even find that we're really cold. Like you and I live somewhere warm. I will see people sometimes who are in a sweatshirt with a scarf on and wearing a hat. And I see them and I'm like, they really need their thyroid checked because they are the coldest person in the room right now. And then that constipation piece, that can actually show up with hypothyroidism, along with the most common symptom, which is being very, very tired.
And that's very important because a lot of women, tell me if this is normal. If a woman, let's put a scenario, a woman gets her first period at 16, which is very late, is in her mid late 40s and has never had regularity in her period. Would that mean that she's getting into menopause or that there is an underlying issue that needs to be addressed? Because I think a lot of women are irregular, like this case that I'm putting as a scenario. And other women, they are regular, but they cross their 40s and there are some imbalances that make them irregular. What could be, you know, those underlying issues? And we'll talk about food after, but what would you be your assessment of these ladies?
This is a fantastic question. I knew we were going to have a great conversation. I'm not just a big fan of yours for no reason. This is such a common scenario and such a great question, because if your periods have always been irregular, greater than 35 days, that's the frequency in which they're coming, or you can't predict when they're coming, what we really need to be investigating is polycystic ovarian syndrome in those cases. So polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, one of the hallmark signs of this is irregular ovulation. If you ovulate irregularly, your periods become irregular. So with that in mind, you also see that there's insulin dysregulation, inflammation, oily skin, hair loss on the head, hair growth on the chin, chest, abdomen. And this isn't like, oh, I'm a Latina and I have a little more hair. This is coarse, thick, looks like it would grow in your armpit. That's called hirsutism. And so these things can show up as polycystic ovarian syndrome. It affects about 10% of women. So if anybody's listening and they're like, this sounds like me, definitely important to have it investigated. Now, in the other scenario, you get into your 40s and things start to become irregular. That's a sign of perimenopause. So menopause is when we have not menstruated, no period, for 12 consecutive months. And at that point, you're in menopause. If you're 45 or older, that's normal. If you're under 45, losing your period is not normal. It could be functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. It can be primary ovarian insufficiency or POI. So we definitely want to investigate that. But if your periods are becoming irregular, Maybe they're coming more frequently. They're becoming heavier. This is a sign of perimenopause. And what perimenopause is the slowing of the function of the ovaries. And that's normal. And they usually accompany things like difficulty sleeping at night, having hot flashes or night sweats, feeling more anxiety, more irritability, you know, irritability, not in just the sense of like, oh, I'm a little cranky. Like, I just can't stand being around people certain days of the month. Or if my partner's chewing with their mouth open, like that's driving me nuts. So we've got those two different scenarios, one in which that is not normal to have irregular periods. And the other is it is normal to start seeing irregular periods, but you don't want to just accept that it's perimenopause because it could be something else like hypothyroidism that we definitely want to investigate. And that's where collecting all of your symptoms and putting it together to understand what's the big picture for you is very, very helpful.
Have you seen cases in these women over 40 that they start being irregular due to low progesterone levels? And when the progesterone regulates either by applying progesterone cream or by eating foods that are more progesterone making encouraging foods, the period become more regular?
Okay, that's also an excellent question. I'm so glad that you asked that, because what is happening in perimenopause is that we're either irregularly ovulating. We don't ovulate every month. Or when we do, what's left behind is a temporary endocrine structure in the ovaries. The ovaries make progesterone. So the only time we make ample progesterone in the cycle is following ovulation. But in perimenopause, because the ovaries are slowing, you might not make enough. And that's exactly why we'll see that the cycles get closer together. So maybe instead of like 30-day cycles, you're now having like 24-day cycles, or sometimes even more regular than that. It's because we're not getting enough progesterone. So yes, supporting the ovaries to produce progesterone can help. If that's not enough, then we bring in the hormone replacement therapy, like a progesterone cream or an oral progesterone, which can help promote sleep and reduce anxiety as well. And that can help to start to regulate those periods. But there will come a point where they do become infrequent and then they disappear. And so it's important to understand that you can have those changes, but you can manage it in the ways that you just suggested so that we don't feel like we're at the mercy of our hormones and we still feel good every day.
And you're an endocrine naturopath. I'm a naturopath, but not endocrine. And I love your specialty. I just love it because it's so related to us. And I always say to women, and this is just my say, I always tell them, do not wish your period to go away. That is our fountain of youth. We as women, if we're moms and we work, those adrenaline glands have a lot of work and it's not easy. What would you say? For these women, like I'm 49, I know my days are counting. It's like I have to be counting how many more periods I'm going to have because average age is what, 52 for a woman to lose their period?
Yes. Yeah. So like I said, it can start as early as 45, but most women are not going into menopause until their early 50s. So, and you're right. Like you are at that stage of like counting down, losing your period. I'm in my early 40s and it's certainly on the horizon. And I'm 100% agree with you. This is your fountain of youth. So estrogen sometimes gets a bad rap because it can contribute to weight gain. It can contribute to PMS, heavy periods. But estrogen is also what keeps our skin soft. It helps with fine lines and wrinkles. So when estrogen starts to decline, our skin can appear to age more and our vaginal tissue can age more. So it can become thin. We have a harder time self-lubricating. Sex can become painful. And then our joints also lose the ability to basically lubricate as well. And so our joints can become achy. So there is so much about estrogen that is wonderful for our overall health. I mean, there's the aesthetic pieces, then there's the functional pieces, and then there's the aspect of our brain health, our heart health, and our bone health. I mean, these things are definitely important to longevity.
Yes, I agree. And I believe there was a study that discussed that after we lose our period, after we are in true menopause, in 3 years, we lose a very large percentage of our bone density because of the estrogen, the lack of estrogen. So ladies, let's love the period. After, you know, the more I became familiar with hormones and more in tune with my own body, every time that my period comes, and I believe that we've been kind of like taught these kind of like, oh, the period, oh, the blood, like we have to be disgusted. But the more in tune, every time that I have my period, I go, thank you, here you are. My youthful hormones are working, because it is something that we should appreciate. And make it as long as it can be there. That's why it's so important what you say, you know, to be healthy. But, you know, you talked before about, you know, what are some of the issues that we have with hormones, but what is the cause? I mean, why are we now, you know, it's like with so many problems, like women have PMS and we have problems not getting periods sometimes. Why is this happening?
There's a lot of reasons, right? We've got the stress of our environment. We are expected to do it all. You know, often people will say like, well, women chose to go to work. And it's like, well, yes. And we should also get help at home. Like this should be shared tasks. So there is the stress. And there is the fact that our modern environment is much more stressful, even just, you know, cars, driving cars. People, we take it for granted, but you're driving a big hunk of metal at like 70 miles per hour. And depending on everybody else on the road to also be safe and alert, you may not recognize it as a stressor because this is just something that you do all the time. But your body is still interpreting these as potential threats. We've got light pollution that disrupts our female circadian rhythm. So not just like the light dark cycle of the circadian rhythm, but how that plays a role on our ovaries as well. So we've got those pieces, but there's also environmental toxins. And we're living in a time where we are inundated with way more endocrine disruptors. So these are chemicals in our environment that have the ability to mimic our hormones, so pretend to be them, but in all the worst ways, or to disrupt them and keep them from working. So it's really, you know, something I think we have to be talking more about what's in our skincare products, what is it that we're cleaning our homes with, and recognizing that within the BIPOC community, there's actually a disproportionate amount of women who are exposed to these endocrine disruptors. We look at the research on Hispanic women and their diagnosis of breast cancer being late in life and these exposures of endocrine disruptors. We look at, there was a study out of Chile that looked at young girls and showed that they had very high levels of endocrine disruptors and started their periods younger. So these chemicals are absolutely impacting our hormonal health on top of the fact that like we've got sleep disturbance, we've got stress, we've got nutritional concerns. It's a lot for a body that has to be in tune with the environment, which is what, if you have ovaries and you have a uterus, you have the potential for life. You have to be more in tune with the environment than a male counterpart, because we have to make sure that it is safe for us and safe for potential offspring.
That's such a great point that we as women, we procreate. So our responsibility is sad that we have so many responsibilities, but we need to be in tune with what's happening inside of our bodies. So what would you recommend? You know, because it gets a little scary, right? It's like, we're not here bringing bad news, but we are bringing kind of news on the fact that there are things that affect, but sometimes like we feel like hand tied, like, oh, what can I do now? There are lifestyle changes and food choices. What are the most helpful ones that you can bring to balance our hormones and that they are good in general?
Sleep is one of the first places I like to start talking about, because so in the book, I actually have a whole chart showing what sleep does to you when you are chronically disrupting it. So the lack of sleep, I should say. And I show from based on the research and the studies we have, it increases inflammation. So if you're inflamed, your hormones actually won't dock onto the cellular receptor. So we have the cell and the hormone comes along and it knocks and it says, hey, I've got a message for you. And the cell has to be receptive to that message. So inflammation can be problematic. So if you're not sleeping, we also see blood sugar dysregulation. So we can see insulin resistance and higher levels of diabetes when we have poor quality sleep. There is disruption in thyroid hormone, of course, the adrenal glands, because they're part of what helps us wake up, but they also need to decline their production of hormones at night so that we go to sleep. And we also lose the protection of melatonin. So melatonin is a sleep hormone, but it also is a potent antioxidant, and it's protecting our ovaries so that they can live long and healthy, but it's also protecting our brain and other tissues as well. And so sleep is one of the places that I really want people to tune into. And I often hear from people say like, well, that's nothing new. Everybody tells us to sleep. And I'm like, well, there's a reason. It's because nobody's doing it very well. And we're getting more and more studies showing that people are chronically sleep deprived. And it is having a major negative impact on not just our hormones, but on our aging of our brain, of our heart, and very important tissues.
it's a great tool and it's free. That's what I tell people. It's
yes.
Out of the things we can do, you know, sometimes we have limited resources, but going to bed on time and not watching the next episode of that Netflix show that is so exciting. You know, you mentioned something really interesting that I'd like to dig in a little bit, because I believe at times we don't quite understand the disruption of a hormone. You said that those endocrine disruptors, they're hormone-like, but they're not real. But then they go to the receptor. And what do they do to the body? What happened? I have my own hormones a little out of balance, and I'm exposed to perfumes, laundry detergent, laundry softener, you know, the little smelly thing that I plug in the wall and cleaning supplies. And then I put my makeup. So I have I'm inundated by all these things and they all pass into my blood. Now, what happens when we look, give me an example, because it's difficult to understand what the role.
When we think about endocrine disruptors, I think the first one that comes to mind for a lot of people is bisphenol A or BPA, because it's gotten a lot of attention because it has a lot of research. So BPA can act like estrogen and it grabs onto the receptor. So now your estrogen cannot dock on that receptor, cannot stimulate it. BPA can then cause cellular changes. It can change your DNA. It can change what is being produced there. And it is sending a different kind of message. So our hormones are chemical messengers. They're conveying information about the environment, the internal and external environment. They're telling cells, like, we need you to do this, turn this on, turn this off. And so BPA can come on and it can stimulate the cells to be turning on genes that it shouldn't be, turning off things that it shouldn't be. As you're talking about scents, those are phthalates that are coming in. Phthalates can be very problematic when it comes to testosterone. So, I mean, let me just say that these endocrine disruptors don't spare any hormones. But as we look at the epidemic of men not producing enough sperm, and it is very problematic, we're seeing that men today have about 50% of the sperm that their grandfathers did. We're also seeing lots of men with low testosterone. We're seeing women with low testosterone. Without testosterone, we have a harder time setting boundaries. We have lower muscle mass. Lower muscle mass means less insulin sensitivity, less hormonal control. And so phthalates can be very problematic with testosterone. And the ironic thing is that sometimes people are lighting scented candles or putting on lotions and perfumes because they're hoping to have a romantic experience with their partner. And yet these very chemicals are blocking their libido, their ability to get in the mood, to get aroused, and to have that kind of connection.
That's something that I have tuned in a lot personally, just because I have kids and it's been always, and where we live, you know, here, the culture is the more, the smellier, the better. Everything has to be perfumed and synthetic smells. But the scents that we have on a liquid softener, or we have in a dryer, or we have in a detergent, those things go into our blood and they create disruption. And sometimes we just don't realize that the body, it's like this glass of water that we keep adding drops. And when it gets to the top, now we are dealing with massive issues that are much harder to solve. You mentioned a favorite hormone to me, testosterone. I think every businesswoman should have a big love for testosterone, just because I want you to tell me, what's the role, because sometimes we think about testosterone for men. I mean, what's the role of testosterone? Why is it so important in us women? And why does it get lower, especially after 40?
Yes. So as I was saying before, testosterone is involved in our muscle mass and helping us build muscle. If you were born with ovaries, you will not build muscle in the same way that a man will. You just won't. Okay. So people always get afraid, like, I don't want to lift weights because then I'll get a bulky body. You can't. You're not built that way genetically. You're not set up that way. You do want to build muscle mass because, as you were talking about, protecting your bone health is really important. Muscle mass is one way that we do that. So testosterone is really important for our muscle mass. As you were talking about with our libido, testosterone and estrogen are involved in why in our brain we desire sex more, why we have more fantasies. If you ever catch yourself and you're like in the store and you see a magazine, or maybe you see a billboard, or maybe you're on social media, you see something and you think like, oh, sex, like your brain just registers that, you're probably at a time in your cycle when your testosterone and estrogen are higher. Testosterone and estrogen also work with tissue arousal and with being able to self-lubricate. That's more of an estrogen phenomenon, but with testosterone, that's going to also keep the pelvic floor healthy. So when you have an orgasm and you're having those contractions in your pelvic floor, testosterone is involved in those muscles there as well. So all muscles in the body. And as you were saying, for business women, it helps you with energy. It helps you set boundaries and it helps you so that you feel motivated. It is a big hormone of motivation as well. And so when testosterone is low, it's very rarely just you have low libido. We also see that maybe you cry more, you feel less motivated. You don't have that same kind of gumption, that get up and go, as people will say in life. And you're not as excited about things. And you find, you know, sometimes people say like, I feel like a total pushover. Like I just feel like I'm being completely pushed over. And so, you know, as we were talking with the endocrine disruptors and you were talking about scents, removing scents from your house is one of the first things that you can do. And I call it a phase out. When you run out of a product, get rid of it. Replace it with something better. The other thing that we can do that's really easy is not wearing shoes inside your house. So if it's an outdoor shoes, don't come into your house. Because if you think about it, what did you just walk through in the parking lot? Would you put gasoline on your skin? Would you put antifreeze on your skin? Would you put these chemicals on your skin knowingly? If it's a no, you shouldn't wear those shoes into your house because they will end up on your skin. And these are just some of the little switches that you can change to help improve your hormones, testosterone being one of those.
There was a study that was done with women, very interesting, that they had women do postures of power. Like,
yes. Yes, yes.
That was really good.
Yeah, Amy Cuddy presented that on a TED Talk. I love that.
And I think it's so cool because even testosterone affects our security. And as women, mm-hmm. you know, if you feel like you're a pushover, maybe you need to do some postures of security yeah. because that raises our physiological testosterone. So that's exciting. So when
we wait, we got to explain what that is though.
Oh, yeah.
So we have to explain what these are because we're telling people to do it. So it's when you take up more space. And so the posture is standing with your feet apart. So legs open, hands on your hips and taking up more space. And not only does it help testosterone, it helps lower your stress hormones as well. And so I love that you bring this up because when we think about what society tells us as women and the messaging we're inundated with, of like lose weight, you want to be this size, it's really a message of take up less space. And so because of that, we see a lot of women who cross their arms, who are kind of curled in, you know, they're sitting on public transportation and they're keeping to themselves. And really what we want to be doing is taking up more space. It's better for our hormones. And that kind of posturing has been shown to actually keep us safe in our environment as well. So potential predators these are other humans who might feel like, oh, I could attack this person. They're easy. They're less inclined to when you're taking up more space. And it may be just the body language they're reading, but it may also be those chemical messages that you're putting out in the environment that you are strong and capable and confident. And even if you don't feel that way, spending like 10 minutes just practicing this in a day can help you get into that state where you do feel that way and your hormones are working for you. I haven't heard anyone talk about that in so long. So I'm so excited. I just got like really excited. I'm so happy you brought that up.
Oh, thank you. I was very excited when I read the study because I felt, you know, as a woman in a, you and I, you know, world mostly dominated by men, sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, it's difficult to find your place and to feel that you belong there and you're not taking up somebody else's spot. And testosterone makes you feel that way. It makes you feel that you belong yeah. there, that you're doing the right thing and that you have the power to just send a message to the world. And when and I notice, like, you know, I'm hormonal just like any other woman. And the time of the first part of the cycle is estrogen and testosterone are rising. I feel like I can eat the world. Make me tell me anything. But then ovulation, progesterone starts kicking in. And I notice that if I don't watch out my testosterone towards the end of the cycle, I'm just like not very motivated. So I'm all for testosterone.
Yeah. Well, the thing about that I talk about in the book with progesterone as well is that you need community to help keep those levels up. And it makes you want to seek community. But also with progesterone during that late luteal phase. So for everybody, that's after ovulation, before menstruation, that phase of the cycle, our caloric needs are up. So we're burning more calories. We need to be eating more. And so that is also part of it too. It's just you're expending more energy as well. So just for people to understand that, like, when you know the phases of this cycle, you can tap in. I mean, especially as entrepreneurs, we know that, like, this is going to be the phase of my cycle that I take the business meetings. I am analytical with the deals. Like, you know, even around ovulation, like before then, we present in a way that is more pleasing to society because of the way our hormones are. Our voice even sounds different. Our voice sounds more attractive. Like, there's a lot of ways to leverage those superpowers. And then as you go into that progesterone heightened phase and you feel more withdrawn and you feel less like that wake up kick ass kind of vibe, that's a good time to come in and start looking back at, like, what have I done? Because as you go through that phase and you get into that analytical sense, you get into the period. And that is where both lobes of the brain really start to communicate and you can plan even more. And so at each phase of the cycle, there's these opportunities that we have that give us a leverage over men because they don't cycle in the same way. They don't have this same set of superpowers that ebbs and flows throughout the month. So I love that we're talking about testosterone. I think that it usually gets a bad rap in women's health because people talk about all the problems of testosterone, but they don't talk about the benefits of testosterone.
And many of those problems, sometimes they are driven by problem with male hormones being altered because our insulin levels are, so we have androgen. Yes. Now we have testosterone issues, but testosterone is not the cause. That's not the problem. It's symptomatic of another underlying health concern. And that is where you talk about PCOS and get to that in your book. Tell me about supplements, because a lot of women, they want to dial in to their hormones and support it with supplements. Any supplements that you like to recommend that can help?
Yes. So this conversation is very nuanced, right? Because it's what hormones are we talking about? What's specific for you? So in the book, I went through supplement protocols and what dosages based on where your results are for your quiz. So if you have high estrogen, so you're the person with heavy, painful periods, you're noticing that maybe you have flu-like symptoms before your period. You have a lot of PMS going on. You're gaining weight in the hips, butt, and thighs. There is the trifecta combo that I really love, which is DIM, sulforaphane, and calcium D-glucarate, which is going to help you with processing your estrogen into the more favorable metabolites. So those are the ones that are less problematic, not only with our periods, but also with our breast tissue. So looking at breast cancer, but also fibrocystic breasts and having lumpy breasts or breast cysts. So those are three things that can really help. If we're talking about progesterone, as we were earlier on and wanting to get our progesterone levels up, vitamin C, vitamin B6, and Vitex are three really helpful ones. Vitex is an herb that will help those ovaries produce progesterone. Now, once the ovaries say, we're done, we're not producing hormones anymore, we're not going to be able to get them to produce progesterone. So what everybody is going to need at that phase, but everybody needs before then as well, is supporting their adrenal glands. So as you were saying, once you get into menopause, it's all about the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands, they also love vitamin C. So we can bring in that and it's a two for one. They also love vitamin B5. And then we can look at adaptogenic herbs, things like rhodiola. So as we were talking about business women, rhodiola is great for energy, but it's also great for mental and physical endurance. So if you're somebody, if you're an athlete, if you're a student, if you're somebody who's in business, rhodiola can be a really great herb for that. And I talk about several different herbs for the adrenal glands in the book, because there's other things we like to use, like ashwagandha, which can help in the evening so that you're getting into that restful sleep. And maybe we'll partner that with phosphatidylserine, which helps your cortisol come down in the evening. So that was a bunch of different examples there, but just to demonstrate that depending on what you have going on, there are things that can help.
And some of them that you've mentioned, like vitamin D3, there are so many studies now of the deficiency. Do you look at if a woman wants to get pregnant, do you look at what ratio of vitamin D you want? How many micrograms per milliliter are you looking at?
So when you look at vitamin D in the blood, we really want to see at least 50, as high as 80 in some people. But if you're getting below 50, that's where we have to start thinking about, okay, what is your sun exposure? Sun exposure is important to a point. This is what we were talking about, sleep and circadian rhythm before. If you want to help your sleep, expose yourself to morning sunlight, getting at least 10 minutes. It's going to help with your vitamin D, but it also will help with your cortisol levels. You know, you and I live somewhere sunny, and people who often are out in the sun think, oh, my vitamin D must be fine. But we find a lot of the times it's not, because we wear a lot of sunscreen. We might live somewhere sunny, but not be in the sun because we're afraid of melanoma and we're afraid of skin cancers. Very real fears to have, yet we need to strike a balance in that. So to answer your question, it needs to be at least 50. There's lots of research out there and experts who agree that around 70 is really ideal and optimal. But it also depends on, you know, when we talk about supplements, like what does your lifestyle look like as well?
You're an endocrine naturopathic physician. Can I talk to you about sex?
Yeah.
I'm
actually a certified sex counselor as well. Oh, so right. We can definitely talk about sex.
In the right place. Because hormones are so important when it comes to sexuality.
Yeah. And
I just wonder, you know, there is something that is called the orgasm gap. Can you explain what that is? Because, and this is important because sometimes these are questions that we don't ask, that sometimes we don't even talk to our best friend about our orgasms, because what is it to be said, especially if you don't have them. But let's talk about it here. What happens with these orgasm gap, and tell me everything about orgasms so I can have even better sex.
Yeah, well, there's a whole chapter on orgasms because I would like to help everybody have more pleasure in their life. I mean, at least the amount of pleasure that they would like to be having in their life. What heterosexual couples report is that a man orgasms about 95% of the time when they have sex, whereas a woman reports 65% of the time. So we're seeing this big gap in pleasure. Men are orgasming a lot more, and women, they're not getting there, at least not with their partner, because we do know from the research is that the majority of women can orgasm on their own. Okay, so non-partnered, they can orgasm on their own, some of which can orgasm as quick as 4 minutes. So it's not the parts are broken or that person can't have an orgasm. There's a big disconnect happening in these heterosexual relationships.
So explain that in more detail, because I'm a little lost. What does that mean?
Most men are going to orgasm with vaginal penetration, and this is well accepted. What most people don't understand is that less than 20% of women are going to orgasm having vaginal penetration. So what most people think of as sex. So if this is all the couple is doing, he's going to have a much higher chance of orgasming than she is. And what it really comes down to is clitoral stimulation. So as I talk about in the book, the penis and the clitoris are the same exact tissue when we are embryos, when we are in the uterus developing. They don't differentiate until there is a testosterone wash in which an XY chromosome responds to. And at that point, the clitoris becomes a penis. So if we understand that we have to stimulate the penis in order to have an orgasm, then it makes sense we have to stimulate the clitoris in order to have an orgasm. And there is research showing that if you stimulate the clitoris first and she has an orgasm, she's actually more likely to orgasm with vaginal penetration. So then everybody gets what they want. And so as I was talking about, I don't think anyone can see this, but I'm wearing a necklace that says clitorit. And that's really what it comes down to, is we need to educate people about the clitoris and make it accessible, which is why I actually had an artist hand draw the clitoris with the vulva around it so that people could see where this crucial sexual tissue lies and be able to end this orgasm gap.
And I interviewed Dr. Miriam Maladib from Spain. She's a gynecologist. And she explained to us in an episode that was about sexuality, how the clitoris is huge. But tell me about the size and where does it go, how it spreads?
Well, you know what's really cool is that we just had the first study published in 2022 showing that there's about 10,000 nerve endings in the clitoris, which is far more than the penis, which makes sense because the penis also passes urine and ejaculate. It's on the outside, so it couldn't be that sensitive. But with the clitoris, there's the small portion on the outside, And then there's a much larger portion. It looks like a wishbone that comes down and it's internal. And why I think this study is really cool, showing us that there's 10,000 nerve endings, is that before everybody would say, oh, there's 8,000 nerve endings. That was based on a cow. That research wasn't done on the human body. So we finally have research on that. The other thing that's really cool is that these nerves that are actually innervating, so the nerves that go into the clitoris, they actually extend, they come up into the uterus. And so it's really fascinating research that we're really just starting to understand the clitoris completely. So it's not an all or nothing. It's not that like you can't have vaginal penetration if you want to be able to orgasm. It's more of understanding that we've got a clitoris, we have to also stimulate it. And so you may try different positions. You may bring in toys. Sometimes men feel threatened by toys. I like to say, you just need to be Batman and these are on your utility belt. Like these are your allies. They are your sidekicks in the bedroom. But using these different things to stimulate the clitoris can help bring her more pleasure and be a little more effective at times to make sure that she can orgasm with vaginal intercourse.
Is it true that after the first orgasm, some women can, if properly stimulated, have multiple orgasms? That sometimes the first one is the one that takes to arrive to that level, and then the body just, it's like, okay, baby, I learned this, now I can go. Yeah. Am I right?
So we talk about this in the book. It's called the refractory period. And for most men, not all men, but most men, they have a longer refractory period. That's why they're a one and done. And that's normal. Okay. So if your partner's like, once I orgasm, I won't be able to orgasm again, that can be a normal experience for men. For women, we have a shorter refractory period. So the time it takes basically for the nerves to reboot and be ready to go again, much shorter. And this is where healthy hormones come in, because when we have those healthy levels of estrogen and testosterone, we are able to achieve multiple orgasms. And sometimes this helps as part of what, you know, people call foreplay. I do, you know, I think foreplay can be great if you do both agree that like you do want to have vaginal penetration. But when we say foreplay, understand that is sex itself, and you can be totally satisfied and have an orgasm then. And that is perfectly normal and wonderful, but understand you can have an orgasm then, you can have an orgasm when you're having vaginal intercourse, you can have an orgasm after that. Even if your partner's like, okay, so you're having sex with the penis and the penis says, I'm done, I'm tired, no more. There's other things that you can do. And so I think so often when we think about sex, it's so much of like, okay, there's a penis and it goes in the vagina and that's it. And we don't recognize that pleasure can go far beyond that. So in the book, I actually have exercises and journal prompts for you to explore this further, to do things like pleasure mapping, to see other areas that cause arousal and cause you to get excited outside of the genitals.
Right. And that's so important, because sometimes like I feel that communication with the partner, it's crucial, because if you yes. tell what you like, your husband is not going to read your mind. And especially speaking about hormones and intuition, some men are intuitive, but I don't know. What do you think that I don't think that a man is going to intuitively know all these what she likes unless you tell him?
You're absolutely right. You have to give some kind of signal with every partner. So when you say like communication, yeah, I think you should be able to talk. If this person you're going to have sex with them, you should be able to have a conversation with them. But also understanding that in the moment, in the bedroom, it doesn't have to be verbal communication. It can be body language. It can show up in different ways, but you do need to communicate. And one tip is to communicate in what you like rather than what you don't like. So saying like, I don't like this, stop this, that can sometimes kill the mood for everybody. And instead saying, oh, I like it when you do this. Could you do more of this? Could you try this? And doing more of that direction, most partners are going to get excited when they know that what they're doing is bringing you pleasure. Now, the one caveat to all of this is if it hurts, absolutely, you can stop at any time and say, don't do this, because there's pain. And pain can show up. I map it out in my book of all the reasons that pain can show up, but it's definitely important not to accept pain as normal and to keep going, because sometimes we can have tissue damage and have problems. But to your point about communication, Absolutely. The number of times in the book I say you need to communicate, communication is sexy, that makes for great sex. When you can have that conversation with your partner outside the bedroom and communicate in whatever ways work for you while you're in the act, I think is excellent.
And speaking about that whole scenario of getting ready for, is it true that women have a lower libido? It's just myth or it's true?
It is false. So women do not just naturally have a lower libido. So this is one of those things that's regarded as normal, right? Women, they can't have orgasms. Making a woman have an orgasm is like finding a unicorn in the forest, or women are just not interested in sex. They don't desire sex. They're not that into it. And in fact, I go through the different models and theories that have come out of the research in the libido chapter. So there's an entire chapter on this, walking you through why it is you might identify as having a low libido, but that's not actually what's going on. So one factor is that we've got spontaneous and responsive desire. And in spontaneous desire, that's what we all see in the movies. It's like you're just instantly thinking about sex. You're instantly turned on. Like you just see someone, you want to have sex. But the responsive desire is what a lot of women actually resonate with. And it may be that you start off spontaneous. And so you're really into your partner in the beginning. And then as things progress, you know, it's 6 months into the relationship and you're like, why am I not feeling the same way? It's normal. You're in your default mode of responsive desire. And what that is you may not be the person to initiate sex. You may not be the person who is just thinking about sex and then, you know, moving to that partner and saying like, I'm interested in sex, I want to have sex. You may be someone that things have to get going. You have to get that sexual stimuli going before you're actually like your brain says, okay, we like this, let's do this. And that is all normal. You may also be someone who has what the research calls more sensitive brakes. So this dual control model where the research has explained the gas pedal and the brakes, which is basically sexual excitation. The gas means go, and sexual inhibition, which is the brakes. And if your brakes are more sensitive, then the things happening in the day-to-day with your relationship, with yourself, your own body image, your stress levels, all of these things can pump the brakes and make it a little harder for you to get in the mood. But none of this is that you're broken. It's just a different way of understanding yourself and understanding that it's not a low libido. It's a different kind of way of interacting with sexual stimuli and different needs.
Well, Dr. Jalene Brighton, you've taught us so much about what it's normal and how to not normalize the things that are problems, to speak with a doctor, get some pointers, and make sure that we know how to recognize any signs of hormonal imbalances. Can you show me your book on camera? Because
yes,
I love the cover. It's so pretty. And I don't have it with me right now. I love the color. It's so cool.
I love the color. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous color. And there's the little hidden vulva on the front because we talk a lot about lady parts.
So cool. I didn't notice. I didn't realize that. That's very nice. That's very nice. Well, everybody that is watching, if you have questions about your hormones, if you wonder if there is normality into what's happening to you, get Dr. Jalene's Brighton book. It's available on Amazon. It's available on any bookstore. It's available in audiobook. It's available on digital. I mean, you can get it, but get it because I think it's so worth it. And personally, I haven't finished this book, but I have read completely more than once Beyond the Pill, which is Dr. Jalene Brighton's first book. And I learned a lot. It was just a fabulous, I think it's a, for any doctor, we should have Beyond the Pill, your first book, is a tool to have in our little baggie. I just feel it's so instrumental for anybody that has female patients. So thanks for your contribution and thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for your time. I loved our conversation and thank you for your excellent questions.
Oh, you're welcome. And where can people find you? Because you are very active on social media. Do you have a website?
You can find me at my main hub, drbrighton.com. That's BRIGHTEN.com. And then you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Dr. Jalene Brighton.
All right. So we'll go find you. Thank you, Jalene. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.